everybody, and welcome to another True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have not been on for, I don't think I've done a show for 3 weeks. So I certainly have not been here to wish you guys all a wonderful, happy, healthy 2020. Holy Toledo, man. That's big time. And I have a wonderful guest for our first show back. His name is Robert Mattson. I have wanted him to come on the show for a long time, and I finally asked him, and he wrote the wonderful book Fireball, Carol Lombard, and The Mystery of Flight 3. So thank you so much for coming on, Robert, and thank you for being my first guest of 2020.
I appreciate the invitation. It's very exciting to talk Fireball again.
I know, because Robert, I want you to come on for the other one, too, Dutch Girl, about Audrey.
Right.
That was your most recent book, but I loved Fireball. I got it when it came out, and it just, because I've always had you in my head, I want to ask him. So I asked you. I finally asked you, and you said yes. So here we are, kids. We're all here. And so tell us, Robert, why did you want to write this book? What inspired you? Because it is a tragedy. There's no happy ending. There's nothing like that. What inspired you to write this book and research it?
I guess I am not a traditional biographer. I don't tell people's stories from birth to death. Mm-hmm. I like to talk about events or pieces of people's lives that I find interesting. And I always thought Carol Lombard was an interesting person, but the definitive biography of her had been written called Screwball in the 1970s by mm-hmm. a newspaper man, and he did a great job, Larry Swindell. So that had been covered. But I always was fascinated by the fact that there was wreckage of that plane still on the mountainside outside of Las Vegas.
How many years later? That was 42, right, when she crashed, or 41?
Right. And that was beginning of 42.
Shush.
So yes. The wreckage is up there, and it's not all up there, and that's a story in itself. But, you know, the fact that it was up there was just so intriguing to me, and I was egged on by a friend of mine that you really need to write this book, and you really need to go to the crash site and then write about it. And so I had to find a way to make all that work and tell the story of this tragic weekend that really, you know, ended this fantastic life and really ended, you know, the innocence of Hollywood during the war years, you know, in its way.
Yes, and you did it. Okay, Robert, so Carol had one incident that could have truly ruined her career. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah, her career could have been ruined right after it started. She had decided, you know, she's living in Los Angeles amongst the film community. That's where her mother settled. So she gets a part in a picture when she's 13, and then when she's 16, she decides she really wants to be an actress. And so she gets a part in a Buck Jones Western, and she does some walk-on background talent appearances, you know, extra work. Mm-hmm. And then she's cast by John Barrymore to be his leading lady in a production of Tempest that's just about to go into production. But she went out with one of her many boyfriends, rich boyfriends, who mm-hmm. had a roadster, and their car crashed, and she went into the windshield. Eek. And tore her face up very, very badly, and mangled her upper lip, mangled her right above her eye, mangled her cheek, very deep facial lacerations that should have ended her career. I mean, she should have looked like Frankenstein. But
yeah.
But her mother, who was very well connected in Los Angeles, got a plastic surgeon to the hospital, called in favors, and that surgeon, with this, you know, relatively cutting-edge new technology of plastic surgery, managed to micro-stitch her back together and gave her a regimen to follow, you know, olive oil and various things to do, keep your head immobilized, and lo and behold, she got fixed enough to resume her career. And she got back into pictures by going to work for Max Sennett for almost no money. And he was making short comedy films. And she became one of his bathing beauties. She didn't have to do close-ups. So, I mean, like, she could still be healing
right.
and make these pictures.
Yeah, I was wondering how long was it between her getting into the accident to her going to Matt Sennett?
She was out of commission for about 7 months.
And she was awake during that surgery.
She was awake during the surgery. That's exactly right, because she couldn't relax her facial muscles. You know, he wanted her. He demanded that she take every stitch without anesthetic.
Tough girl, Fireball, that's for sure. She was something else. So she went to that. But you can still see, and in the book I saw, which was interesting, the one with her cheek. That's the one I can see. But I didn't even see the one on her lip. And I've never really noticed one on her eyebrow. So the only one I have seen, even with really good lighting and stuff, is the one on her cheek, which was, you can tell, was very deep.
Well, her friend Alice Marble did an audio interview in the 1970s. It's really great. You can hear her, you know, she's got like a scotch and soda and she's drinking and she's talking about her friend. And she mentions these other scars, which really, and then I started to look for them. And then it was like, oh, yeah, you can really see them if you're looking for them. But it was kind of a well-kept secret that was lost to history, that she had these other scars beyond the one that you can see in her cheek.
Yeah, but she still was beautiful Carol, that's for sure.
Sure.
So Carol, of course, does well. She starts doing pre-code films, and she's not the funny girl yet. She's doing I Love Virtue. Have you ever seen it?
I have seen Virtue, yeah. Yeah,
I thought Mayo Metho ran away with it, although both Carol and Pat O'Brien and were fabulous.
Yeah, it's a very nice little gritty short pre-code.
Mm-hmm. And she did a bunch of others. And I think, when did she meet Ross Colombo? When was that going on?
That was 1933. That was after her marriage to William Powell.
Oh,
now, I have to correct one thing.
What?
I wrote this book and researched this book in 2012, 2013, and I can't remember yesterday. So I misspoke when I said that she had done the Sennett shorts before her accident. That was after her accident. That was the thing that brought her back, was taking a chance with Max Sennett and him taking a chance with her, and that relaunched her career. So I don't want people to think, oh, he doesn't even know what he's talking about. But it has been a while. So she met Colombo after she divorced William Powell, and they started. Russ Colombo was the mid-20s singing sensation, younger than her, and they started a very passionate little relationship there that ended very suddenly and very tragically.
Yeah, he was, Carol thought he was too possessive in many respects, and at times she would say, we're going to get married, at times not, but, and I also read, I had Victoria Riskin, Robert Riskin, the screenwriter,
sure.
he married Faye Ray. So I had their daughter on. She wrote a really good book. And I read twice when I was researching certain things on Carol that she had said that Ross Colombo was the love of her life. But I don't buy it.
No, I don't buy it either. There was a lot of spin on the story after he died, mm-hmm. and her reaction to it, and it made such great cannon fodder for the publicity mill, mm-hmm. and for the newspapers, and so it was turned into this horrible, horrible, tragic thing, and it took her a year to get over and all that, and it was very tragic.
Why don't you tell everybody what happened?
Yeah. So, she. Clark Gable was right. He's the one that brought her, back to some sense of happiness after the Colombo thing ended. Men wanted to date her, George Raft wanted to date her. She was seen a lot with Cesar Romero, even though.
Well, we know he was a one. Yeah. I'd love to have gone out with Cesar Romero as an escort, because he probably had all the goods on everybody. I would have loved to.
He was,
talk to him.
Somebody should do the definitive book on Cesar Romero. He is the coolest guy in Hollywood, if you ask me.
I would have loved to hang out with him. I really would have, because all the women did. They loved him. He was escorting everybody, and he had a great sense of humor from quotes I've read about him.
Yes, he did.
But I just wanted to... you tell everybody how Ross Colombo died, because we said it was a tragedy, but boy, it was just such a weird, horrible stroke of luck of how this poor guy died.
Yeah, he was with his best friend, who was a photographer in Hollywood, and the friend supposedly was playing with a dueling pistol that he says he didn't know was loaded, and it went off in his study, and it didn't even hit Russ Colombo, right. It wasn't pointed at him. The bullet bounced off the desktop.
It ricocheted,
Ricocheted into his eye and just went in far enough to cause a catastrophic wound to his brain and kill him in a matter of a couple of hours. And it just, I don't know. I'm not sure that whole story adds up. But,
me either. Yeah. But nobody's proven otherwise, so I guess that's a story they stick to. Also, she and Clark had met earlier in 19... Was the movie 32 or 33, No Man of Her
32.
Own?
32. Yeah. No Man of Her Own was 32.
But it was like... She was married to Powell, and he was having a... He was married to Rhea, the lady who was much older than him. But he and Joan Crawford had this huge, passionate romance going on, which they were told, MGM said, knock it off, or you're out of here. And he did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so then they get together, and I read they meet at a ball, which is kind of cool. And from then on, they're together.
Yeah, beginning of 36, and they're both... ripe for a relationship, and it starts up that night, and it just went on through the end of her life, 6 years later.
Yes. There was this expose in one of the gossip magazines of unmarried married couples or whatever, living together without marriage. Barbara Stanwyck and Robert Taylor were one of them, as were Clark and Carol.
Right.
And his wife was a socialite, this Rhea. He moved up from Josephine, and he got Rhea, but, he cheated on her left and right. And finally, she was so embarrassed, and he had to come to action, and she divorced him. And they got married to make everybody happy.
Right. It was quite the scandal, because they were so out there. Clark and Carol, and it was America is still kind of puritanical in its way, but it was much more so in the 30s. And and when this thing came out, Kurt Lee Baskette was the writer, and Carol kind of felt stabbed in the back by this guy, because she had given him good stories, and this thing was a game changer, and it forced MGM to capitulate with Rhea and make it possible and necessary for Gable and Lombard to be married.
And they did. And they really loved each other from everything I've read. He thought she was the cat's meow. She really loved him very much. I do read, and you talk about his infidelities, and Carol knew about them. She sort of fluffed him off because he was a guy. I mean... They say you're as faithful as your whatever chances, as what you're offered. And women were throwing themselves at him, and he did not always throw them back.
Well, now you're being very kind. He was a wolf, and he really enjoyed women. And she knew that this was the price you paid for a relationship with Clark Gable. And people, even today, there are a lot of defenders that said, they were soulmates and all this and whatever. I think it was a much more realistic relationship than that on both sides. he realized a little too late exactly what he had in her and what she had given him and what she was offering him. And she was always the wise one in that relationship, and the one who practiced forbearance, except on certain occasions when, you know, she did stand up for herself and say, this is where I draw the line. And the line was, of course, Lana Turner.
Yes, I love that story. And Lana, she would always come in, and Lana would storm off of the set because Carol's watching her. Did Clark, do you think, have an affair with Lana?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I don't think there's any question about that. And that's really what set Lombard off, was the fact that he really was, you know, this girl was a threat because she was basically Carol Lombard, but 10 years younger, you know, the very sexy blonde. But instead of 32 years old, 33 years old, like Carol was, this girl was 22, you know, and all too willing. Lana was a sort of desperately insecure girl who really needed a lot of affirmation.
Yes, and I think he did too. That was his thing, that, oh, yes, I'm God's gift to women. And so,
and of course, know, that hides deep insecurity. You know,
it's,
I
of gave course.
Her insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
it's just awful. You know, in your book, I found out something. She was also not too happy about Virginia Gray. I knew that he had dated Virginia Gray after Carol had died, but he had seen her prior?
Yeah, that's another one that was just long simmering, and Virginia Gray was always there for him, and really, he was the only guy for Virginia Gray.
She never married.
Life.
Yeah, she never married.
Right.
She always thought he'd come back to her, I think.
Yeah, and I don't think that Lombard really considered her to be
competition.
She was in a different category. She's such a sweet woman. That,
yeah.
You know, Virginia Gray, nobody ever had a bad word to say about her. And I think that Carol understood that there was this unrequited love there, but Gabe Bull would go and use her. So that was different. That was different than Lana. Lana was just an out-and-out threat.
But Carol also felt that he would never leave her because he would get really raked over the coals in the public's eye.
Yeah, but there was talk at the time of her death that she was talking to lawyers about leaving him.
Hmm.
There were, if you look in some of the files at the Academy Library, there were some just vague notes about the fact that, you know, she had seen lawyers. There wasn't enough evidence to really go in that direction, but there is some smoke, maybe a fire.
Or perhaps she was just choosing her options, and maybe, I don't know, I couldn't put up with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I would just go nuts. You don't want to have to babysit your husband when he's on a movie set, you know, and stare down the chick he might be, you know, bonking, you know?
Right.
It just doesn't sound like a fun life to me.
No.
But a lot of people will take this as, you know, not true, because I can't believe that he would, you know, they were the perfect love story and that they wouldn't cheat. Because I wrote this thing about Humphrey Bogart, and this woman wrote a book about, she was his hair wig maker or something, and she had an affair with him prior to his marriage to Lauren and after, and she's writing a love story. It wasn't a love story. I believe he did have sex with this woman. I don't mm-hmm. believe he was in love with this woman. I believe Lauren was very young when they got married, and he had a lot of doubts about it. But if she tried to say something bad about Lauren, he would defend her. But, you know, people were like, no, not that. That never happened. Couldn't happen.
Right.
Because of the images in people's heads.
Yeah, and what Gable and Lombard represent to a lot of people, you know, the perfect looking couple and their perfect love. And that's fine if that's the way
yes.
you want to.
And I do think that they loved each other very much. I read that in sure. your book, Carol tried to draw Clark out of himself because he never talked about feelings or, you know, things that were really, you know, he had a lot of stuff in him that he just couldn't get out.
Right. And back then they called it being a man's man, you know,
right?
But really, there was a lot of crap in his head that was unresolved, and he had used people a lot, as you alluded, you know, his first wife,
Josephine,
the acting coach,
yeah,
Josephine Dillon, and then Rhea, just climbing his way up the ladder. So, I mean, like, he had some guilt, I guess, probably some shame. He probably wasn't happy with his own looks, with the ears and everything. He had a lot to deal with, and Carol did try to humanize him and get him to be a less unhappy person.
Yes. So I think at times he was a less unhappy person, and I think she did bring a lot of joy into his life. And like you said, perhaps he noticed it a little too late, but she then did a series. She said, I want to do, after doing like the 20th century or Mildred plot, right? Those things. She wanted to do drama. So she started doing, she did A Name Only, which I love because of Kay Francis. She was wonderful. And the one, Vigil in the Night, where she played
a nurse.
Yeah. And she had to stand up for Anne Shirley, who kept making mistakes. And those didn't do well. And then she did another one that didn't do well, and she wasn't doing so hot. And the last film she did prior to her going away was To Have and To Have Not.
To Be or Not to Be.
To Be or Not to Be.
Yeah, you got Gable on the brain.
Yeah. To Have and To Have Not. Isn't that Bogey? To Have and To Have Not, Bogey.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Bogart McCall. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so she did that one, and she had finished it with Jack Benny, and then Pearl Harbor got bombed, and Hollywood braced up, tons of guys enlisted, so many things were happening, and then they wanted whoever was on hiatus to sell war bonds. So Carol was gung-ho, and she wanted Clark to go with her, but he did not want to go, and
who wouldn't want to go to Indiana in January?
Gee whiz. I don't know. I really don't know. And what's so sad to me, he didn't want to go. Carol wanted to go. So she took her mom, and he sort of said to his friend, what's his friend, Buzz?
Otto Winkler?
Otto Winkler. I want you to go and take care of Carol. And prior to them leaving, how horrible was this? He woke up in a sweat and didn't talk to his wife until they were having dinner. And he said, I dreamt of my own death. If I fly in a plane, I'm not coming back. Right?
Yeah, he broke into tears. Yeah.
How horrible.
His wife recounted that story. It was I found this, you know, piece of writing that she had. I didn't find it. It was actually given by Jill Winkler's niece. She was very helpful in the construction of the book and the story. And I had long conversations with her on the phone, and she forwarded me material, and that was included in the material.
That broke my heart. It really did. And she promised, because her mother never wanted to fly a plane, she promised them that there would be no plane.
Right.
Well, they were off, and she was briefly from Indianapolis, correct?
She was from Fort Wayne.
Mm-hmm. Indiana,
she was born
yeah.
Born in Fort Wayne, yeah. And so they took the train up through Chicago and then to Indianapolis. They did some bond activities in Chicago, and then they made their way to Indianapolis. I think her mother took a side trip to Fort Wayne and then met up with her in Indianapolis. Yeah.
And so how long did the train take to get them there? But they made intermittent stops.
Yeah, a few stops for bond purposes. It took them like 2.5 days to get from Los Angeles to Chicago.
Yeah, that gets me. We'll discuss that later too. So they do that, and she is a total success. She goes to all these places. She sells millions and millions of dollars of war bonds. And you see the Did you see the last thing where she says V for victory and she's leading him into that? And basically, that's the last picture of Carol you have of her alive, right?
There were some photos taken at a little family get together in the hotel in Indianapolis that night. But yeah, there's a series of photos that were supposed to run in Life magazine, which my publisher purchased this whole series of photos.
Wow.
Taken, but they were sitting in a trunk for, you know, 70 years, and my publisher found them and got the negatives. And that's a lot of the photos that appear in Fireball are from that collection.
Very cool. So she went there. She was happy. But she, rumor has it that Clark and she had a falling out before she left.
Right. I'm not sure that's a rumor. A number of people who
yes.
were in the know told me that, including Carol's nephew
mm-hmm.
and this woman, Jill Winkler's niece, told me that too, and even another person. So yeah, I mean, it was pretty well known inside the family
mm-hmm.
that this
they were
that
on the outs
that fight had happened about Lana. You know, stay away from Lana.
Well, they were doing another film together, right?
Right. That's Somewhere I'll Find You had started production right when Carol left, and Clark used that as another reason why I can't leave. I'm starting this picture
with this cute little tomato here. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I do this, and I didn't know that there's such communities, but I did a series on blonde bombshells with a woman who's an expert on blonde bombshells, classic movie blonde bombshells. And she said that in the Carol and Clark community, people blame Lana for Carol's death.
They do, and Lana refused to take any responsibility for that. And really, you know, I think that's a pretty wise course.
I agree.
You have the rest of your life to live. You know, you just can't sit in a dark room and feel guilty for the rest of your life. So she said, you know, I didn't make Carol get on that plane.
She didn't.
And it's absolutely true.
She did not. So Carol did that. And then one night she says to her mother and to poor Otto, I've decided, I've got us tickets, we're going to fly.
Yeah, she made Otto go check into flights and book them something because she did not want to face 2.5 days back on the train. She wanted to get home. She actually had appearances scheduled in Indianapolis for the next morning after she finished her bond selling, and she canceled those and said, we're going home. And her mother was mortified because she had never flown in a plane. Carol had promised she wouldn't have to fly in a plane, and now they were going to be flying in a plane.
And Otto, I'm sure, was freaking. And then they did. Carol said, okay, let's do a coin toss.
Right. Yeah, and that story came from eyewitnesses at the airport, I guess. And they did. They flipped a coin, and Carol won, you know, in quotes. And so they headed for the airport and got on this TWA plane. I didn't know anything about this, but, you know, back in that time, it was coast to coast in 18 hours.
Wow.
And it's not like a transcontinental flight today where you get on a jet in New York at LaGuardia and then you step off in Los Angeles. It's not like that at all. You got on this Hedgehopper TWA plane that made all of these stops across country. So, you know, every landing and every takeoff, those poor people, you know, Carol's mother and Otto Winkler must have been sweating.
Yeah, and to me, I'm reading this and I'm saying, here you go. You can be on a train 2.5 days without this getting off the plane, wait a layover for an hour or two, then getting on the plane again. And then it just didn't make sense, really. I mean, how much faster was she going to get home?
Yeah, and the flight three had everything go wrong that could go wrong, really. I mean, you know, you're flying in January across the United States. You're going to hit weather somewhere. And they hit weather in St. Louis and Kansas City and heading down into Texas. And, you know, they just had delay after delay. And then all of these Army guys get on at Albuquerque and bump passengers off the plane, and there's a big hullabaloo, and they tried to bump Carol and her mother and Otto, which wouldn't it have been great if they had been bumped, but she insisted on staying on the plane, so there was more delay, which, you know.
Don't you know who I am? She pulled that one.
Yeah.
So they had to get 7 civilians off the plane to let the soldiers come on.
Yeah, and one of the coolest things, one of the greatest things that happened to me on the creation of this book is that I met one of the people who was bumped in Albuquerque.
Oh, my God.
Flown across the country with right sitting, you know, I think right behind Carol Lombard. And this girl was so excited because she was going to – do we need to wait for that? It's not for you, is it?
What?
The ambulance.
Oh, no, it's not for me. It'll go out. People know I'm filming in the city, New York City. So, you know, we have it here. It goes there. So
this the girl who was on the plane, her name was Mary Johnson, and she had been working for the government in D.C. And she was thrilled because she knew she was going to stay on the plane long enough to see Clark Gable when Yeah.
That's so cool. Suddenly, you met her.
Oh, yeah. Very near the end of her life. And I got to hand her a copy of Fireball in her nursing home in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And we had a wonderful visit. And then she died like 2 months later.
Wow. And she must have just said, you know, at the time I was furious, but oh, my God, you know, I'm sure
exactly.
She was.
But, yeah, and lived to be, what, 93. You know, she would have died the next day.
How awful. So that was this last stop before they head into Las Vegas?
Albuquerque, yeah. They were supposed to fly into Boulder City, which is outside of Vegas. There were no landing lights at Boulder City, and they had gotten so late because of all these cascading delays that now they have to fly into McCarran Airport at Las Vegas, and this isn't the McCarran that's there now where everybody flies into. This was actually Nellis Air Force Base is where McCarran was at that time. So they fly into McCarran right near dark and take on fuel to make it over the mountains for the last leg.
And they had tons of gear from the soldiers and stuff. This is, what do they call it, like luxury flying, but it really was as far from luxury flying as you can get. But that was flying in those days, and so I guess it was luxury flying because people really don't fly too much. And Carol sat in the front. Did they have a long delay there?
No, they were on the ground. They were supposed to be on the ground 20 minutes. I think they were on the ground 40 minutes. They had to check the load, check the center of gravity, get fuel on the plane, and get out of there.
These pilots were, the main pilot, he had thousands of hours of flying, and everybody said he was a very, very good pilot, wonderful pilot.
Yes, yes, he was the most experienced pilot in the TWA fleet.
And his co-pilot he was not sauerkraut. He was fine himself.
Yeah, you know, he was a studious, younger co-pilot. He had hundreds of hours of experience. Wayne Williams, the pilot, had like 26,000 hours of experience.
Amazing.
So,
yeah. So they're all set. And are there lights in Las Vegas to get them off?
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember. But if they're still flying, the lights aren't important to take off in Las Vegas because they had light enough to get up in the air then.
Yes.
They're okay.
But I recall as they were getting up, the guy sees flames and he heard weird sounds. Like, I don't know if he's the traffic control guy or whatever, but he sees flames coming out of this plane. And it just weird sounds. And it's like, don't you stop them? Hey, there's flames there. That can't be good. That just can't be good.
Well, that's the fuel mixture. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But the sound was important because of the fact that the plane was so burdened by its load. Mm-hmm. You know, it was technically, it was too heavy to fly. And they should have lightened the load before they took off.
Definitely. So he takes off. What time do they, do you remember the time that they took off?
It's like 7:07, I think. It was around 7 o'clock, right at dark when they took off.
Uh-huh. And they have contact, and then they lose contact, correct? Pretty soon after.
Yeah, they're climbing. They're climbing to cruising altitude, which is about 10,000. And 15 minutes after takeoff, they lose contact.
And then when did it crash?
15 minutes after takeoff.
So it was right there. And the weird thing was that that was not the regular path that the pilot would go.
No. The co-pilot had filed a flight plan that assumed that they were going to fly into Boulder City and fly out of Boulder City, which is to the south. And so they were on the wrong heading when they flew out of Las Vegas. And that heading took them straight into the mountain. And that should be the cause of the crash. But why didn't the pilot see the mountain coming?
Yeah.
Nobody can quite explain that. So they claim then. So then that gave rise to a wild story that the pilot was too busy, you know, entertaining Carol Lombard and he was supposedly back in the main cabin when the plane crashed, which I don't believe at all.
I don't believe that either, especially when you're just taking off and you're climbing and trying to get to the proper altitude.
Right.
I don't believe it either.
No. So the speculation then is that he was filling his logbook. You know, he had a flashlight and he was entering information about his stop at Las Vegas in his logbook right at that moment, and that the controls were actually in the hands of the co-pilot.
Yeah, it's horrifying. And so some miners, they hear the explosion.
They hear the plane flying over, and they hear it, you know, its engines are really revving, and they see this flash. They actually can feel it in the ground because the impact was so catastrophic, and this is really one big rock, this mountain, and they're at the bottom of it, and they feel it, and they go outside, and they see, you know, the glow of a fire on the mountain, and that sets into motion this great catastrophic reaction, you know, in Las Vegas and at McCarran Field, and you know, everybody starts to try to figure out, how are we going to get there? Where is there? And how are we going to get there?
Because that mountain was not somewhere people would climb. It was not like a yodelay hee hoo kind of, you know, a St. Bernard's going to rescue me mountain. It was steep, and you'll tell us about it later because you climbed it. But it was very difficult to get up there. So it took a while for real rescuers to go, but a couple of people went up there, climbed up. One was, I can't remember his name. They weren't really, they were just regular guys who climbed up there. And I believe they saw some things. They saw two guys who were out of the plane in the snow, and it looked like they perhaps could have lived if somebody had found them, two soldiers?
Yeah. Yeah, and you can see them in some of the crash photos lying there intact. And that was one of the things about the crash investigation, the crash recovery, was that everyone was, you know, just cut to ribbons. But that these guys had been thrown clear.
You wonder if that was true. I wonder if they ever did an examination. They were dead, yes, but it's fascinating to know if two men could have actually survived that crash.
Yeah.
So they got up there and they were waiting. I know by this time, the air control, and they all know that the plane is missing. Do they know about the crash?
Yeah, I mean, the fireball made it pretty clear that the plane had impacted the mountain. But what they didn't know was, you know, did this plane have some sort of a controlled landing and there were survivors and then it had caught fire? Or what was the situation? Because it was so far away. It was 30 miles from Vegas, 33 miles from McCarran. And it was night, and the mountain is so rough with so many foothills and so many peaks that nobody knew exactly what the story was way over there. So there were a number of responses. You know, there were efforts from the south. There were efforts from the north. There were efforts from the east. All these different groups are trying to reach this plane, you know, desperate to find what the situation is. And is Carol Lombard alive? And am I going to be the one that rescues her?
Yeah. And so she's supposed to be home that night, correct? She's
right.
Supposed to be flying in. And so when does Clark find out that the plane is missing? It's gone down, they believe.
There's a, you know, he's at the ranch that he had with her in Encino. He was arranging a party, and they were all sitting there waiting for her to come in the door. And instead, he gets a phone call at like 8 o'clock or quarter after eight that their plane is down outside of Las Vegas. And he's, of course, shocked. Some MGM people race over to Encino, and they get Gable and take him to Burbank, and they fly out of Burbank and straight to Las Vegas on another DC-3 to find out exactly what's going on.
What's that guy's name? Eddie Mannix, who is a fixer?
Eddie Mannix was the vice president of operations for MGM. So, I mean, this is the second in command, really, to Louis B. Mayer. Just to call him a fixer is too simplistic. He was a company man. He was a very high executive at MGM who all he had to do was sign, you know, EM, and he got that plane, and they took off.
And then Clark, did he go immediately to the site?
No, because they came in the night, and he had to cool his heels at McCarran, and then he was taken to the El Rancho Las Vegas, which was the only hotel or motel. It was a motel and casino in Vegas to just wait for information, because they had to try to get to the plane. And then finally, he couldn't take it anymore. And on the morning of the 17th of January, which was a Saturday morning, he demanded to go to the crash site himself and to climb up there and find his wife.
But they didn't let him do it.
No, he did go.
He went. I know,
yeah,
he
Clark
went.
Gable was not going to be told no. He was the king of Hollywood,
right.
And he was a rough, tough guy. And when he wanted something, you know, nobody was going to tell him no. And so he did. He was driven by the Good Springs route and up to the base of the mountain to, you know, the operations, forward operations for this rescue effort. And he started to make the climb, and I know exactly where he went. And he got to a certain point, and they came down the mountain and told him, you know, don't go any further. There's no point.
Oh, because that next morning, more people had gotten there, and everything was everywhere, you know, people's bras and trees, things like that. Did they find Carol that morning?
She was found in the early afternoon and identified by one of the MGM guys that went up the mountain. And it's a cool part of the story that none of these people were ready for mountain climbing in the winter through a foot of snow.
Yeah, they were wearing regular clothes, some of them. I think Eddie Mannix went up and he was wearing a suit and just like Florsheim shoes. Who knows? I don't know.
So somebody made the ID of her by her hair color. Like, she was the only blonde on the plane.
A wisp. That was it, because she was not recognizable other than that. She had been burned. They thought they found the mother. They found Otto. But then they saw that the mother wasn't the mother, and then they finally found the mother. And they were all, you know, up by the pilots. And it just was horrible, the wreckage. And then Clark went back. And he was told, and what did they find? They also found, like, some kind of earring or pin she was wearing.
They found a piece of one of the, supposedly found a piece of one of the diamond and ruby clips that she wore everywhere. And you know, those clips are seen in every photograph of Carol Lombard when she's dressed up. And supposedly he got a fragment of one of those.
So he knew, and they said, you do not want to see her. It's her, but you're not going to see her. And in your book, you say Spencer Tracy drove there, and he stayed with Clark, and they got royally drunk. And he was basically there for his pal during that time.
Yeah.
And it's so horrible. So the people that died on the plane were the captain, co-pilot, Carol, Otto, Carol's mom, and the rest were soldiers.
There was an air hostess, Alice Getz.
Oh, yes.
I spoke to her niece. And there were 15 Army Air Corps personnel from the ferrying command. They were pilots, navigators, co-pilots, engineers, and they were taking bombers from the West Coast, from Long Beach and Santa Monica. They would take them east. They would take them to Canada, to New York, whatever. And then they would hop a flight back. And that's what they were doing. They were going back to Long Beach to get some more planes. So there were 15 of them on the plane.
Now I'm thinking there was another woman, too, because she said, I have to meet my husband and he's only going to be here for something. I believe they let her go on, too, didn't they?
Yeah, that was Lois Hamilton, and yes, she did get to go through because she was a military dependent.
Mm. Holy heartbreak! So they all got up there, and how did they get the remains down the mountain?
They put them on pack horses and led them across the ridges and then down. This back way, you know, a long circuitous route. And one of the pack animals actually went off the side of the mountain and was had to be destroyed. And that
poor beast.
Yeah, and that one had Carol's mother and Otto Winkler's bodies on it, I believe. At least it was Carol's mother. And so it's just to add insult to injury.
She just didn't have any luck. The threes, the whole thing, and a promise by Carol that was not kept. So Clark stayed there until Carol was brought down, and all the he wanted to stay until all the bodies, Otto, his mother-in-law, the whole thing. And then he went back to Los Angeles.
Right, on the train with his wife's body, and had to arrange her funeral,
which is
at Forest Lawn.
Yeah, which is interesting because when you think of it and how it was sort of a creepy foretelling of her future, Carol and Clark had gone to Jean Harlow's funeral, and she said, "Listen, don't let me have that kind of thing. You know, it was just out of control. I want it to be quiet. I want, if I die before you." And that's exactly what he did. He did not have a big funeral. He had it quiet. And he followed her directions.
Yeah, it was very small, and it was at a different church at Forest Lawn than Harlow's had been at. The Church of the Recessionals, way up at the top of the hill, and in much more private, and I think it was, there were 15 couples or something. It was just their very, very closest friends, no photographers, and a private event.
And it was her mom and Carol, and then Clark was to be buried there as well when he died.
Right.
So he became, Hollywood was in shock that this vital young woman was dead. He was in shock, and I believe, you know, he had a combo of guilt and that he was not treat her the way she should have. And he really did miss her, because when you read these stories about women who dated him after she died, they said how morose he was, how often he talked about Carol, and, you know, that they didn't want to be with him because it was always, you know, something would talk and then it would change into Carol. So he didn't remarry for a long time, and he went into, what did he go into, the Air Force, the Army?
Yeah, he joined the Army Air Corps because he wanted to die overseas. I mean, he really did not care about living after she died, and his drinking intensified greatly. He did go into the Army Air Corps. He tried to make a motion picture. He was flying out of England, went on a few bombing missions to make this movie. He actually did get in combat, and he almost got shot. You know, he almost, you know, bullets came very near him, and unfortunately, as far as he was concerned, did not hit him and kill him. He wanted to die in a plane like she had and just get it over with.
Yeah, but he married two other women. One was just a quickie wicky, and then he married Kay, his final wife, and then he did The Misfits with Montgomery Clift in Maryland, and his wife was pregnant, and he died, 3 weeks after shooting The Misfits?
Yeah, supposedly The Misfits was really, really tough on him. You know, he made it in Nevada, north of where Carol had died.
Hot as H-E double toothpicks.
Yeah, and Marilyn was a problem on the set and was always late, you know, the typical pulling the Marilyn stuff. Mm-hmm. And he was working on his car in his driveway at Encino and had a heart attack.
And he died, and his son was born 2 months later, right? 2 or 3 months mm-hmm. later?
Yeah.
And I believe when we did our Blonde Shell thing, people thought that Kay blamed Marilyn in part for her husband's death.
I can't speak to that. I didn't really look so much at that part of their lives. Kay was not very well liked by Clark's longtime friends at all, and people don't really realize that.
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah.
Why not? What did they think? She was just like a user or something?
She was not a warm person at all, and they thought she was a poser, you know, that she was trying to pretend she was Carol Lombard, but with none of the charm, and she was also very jealous of Clark's friends, and so she tried to cut him off from them, and this comes from Howard Strickling, you know, his longtime MGM yeah. press boss. And many other friends, I'd listened to a lot of interviews, candid interviews with these people that had been done in the 70s, and it was really an eye-opener.
Yeah, because I didn't read that. I'll have to check that out myself. So I'd like you to tell us about your climb. You took this upon yourself. You said, okay, I'm going to go up there. It's hard to go. Let me see how it works. So tell us about it.
Well, yeah, I did not think I could write this book, which was about, in part, about the rescue effort to get up to the crash site without actually experiencing the climb. And so I wanted to go over the same route that the first responders had took. Mm-hmm. I got myself the best guide I could get, you know, somebody who routinely climbed the mountain, knew the mountain, His name was Jim Boone, and he took my wife and me. He looked at us. We both run. We both lift. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in pretty good shape. And he looked at us and was like, I don't know if you're going to make it or not. And so Mary made it part of the way up the mountain. And we realized we were burning too much daylight. We started at dawn, and it was like 10:30 or 11 o'clock when he said, look, we're not going to make it. And so Mary waited, and I kept going behind him and got to the crash site and had 1 hour at the crash site. I mean, it is a sheer mountainside, and it's very dangerous. And the last guy that he had tried to take up the mountain to the crash site had broken something, ribs or something.
Yikes.
And didn't make it. And so we got up there, and I had some video going, and you can see some of that on YouTube in the book trailer for Fireball. Mm-hmm. I did my investigating, and Jim went off. He came over, and he said showed me a bone. He had found human remains at the crash site. And as a matter of fact, 2 years after I climbed, they found an intact body of one of the flyers up there.
Wow.
At the crash site. That's how rough the terrain is and how rough that crash was.
And how many years later? That's amazing.
Yeah, like 72 years later.
Did you see fuselage and stuff like that?
Oh, sure. Back at that time, you could pick up a piece of fuselage that was 6 feet across. And I think it's been pilfered a lot more since then. But we were up there for 1 hour, and I took some video. I got the sense of the place as much as I could. And really, the strangest thing that happened was, you know, I felt the other passengers so strongly. I felt they were trying to communicate with me as if to say, look, you know, we're here. We want to be remembered. It hit me so strong. And
I believe that. I believe that that happened.
It changed the focus. I mean, like, I had to now research these people and find out who they were and find out where they were from.
Lovely, lovely people, all of them.
Yeah.
And holy heartbreak,
yeah.
The two brothers. Like I said, I cried. So mission accomplished in that. It was heart-wrenching. And it really was a wonderful book. And like I say, it's not, you know, something you're going to come out away from, and it's not like a feel-good book, but it is very interesting, and you really get the feeling of that last flight, of Carol's flight. And I like what you write. You wrote three reasons that Carol could have lived.
What were they? That sounds interesting. Tell me more.
I believe one was, had she not flown, had she not flipped that coin, and mm-hmm. had she just gotten off and taken the train?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's all true. I mean, it's been a long time.
I know.
But it's there are so many ironies. There are so many things. If, you know, little things had just happened differently, she would have had a long career. She would have ended up in television. She would have had a show just like Loretta Young had, more successful than that, because she was such a brilliant comedian. Everything changed just because of these deaths by a thousand little cuts.
Yeah. Yes, and my heart just goes out to everyone that was on that flight. She didn't cause the flight, that's for sure, to crash. Did they ever, ever find the reason why it crashed, or is that still a big mystery? They have theories, but they never came to anything conclusive. I don't know if they had black boxes then. I doubt it, right?
No, there were no black boxes. They attributed it to pilot error, and you have to call it pilot error. You know, there's really no big mystery that it was pilot error that a plane smashed into a mountainside. But, you know, how it was pilot error, that has never been proven. That was never proven. You know, how they didn't see the mountain coming when the pilot who flew the first transport over the crash site to ID it for the control tower back in Vegas, he testified later, I could see the mountain. I mean, I was looking at the mountain before I knew there was a crash. So even in the dark, you could see the peak, but these guys did not see the peak. I don't get it. I don't know. But
ironically, how long ago was there another crash there?
Oh, there are crashes periodically in that mountain, but it was very interesting to me because I used to work for NASA, that a NASA plane hit very close to that spot in a very similar manner, mm-hmm. With two wildly experienced pilots and all the latest, you know, cockpit hardware in 2007, and still they hit the mountain under full control. So, I mean, like, it's a very treacherous place, and it causes mysterious crashes.
And horrible deaths for all those involved. I want to thank you so much, Robert. His book is fabulous. And The Little Dutch Girl, which I hope. Will you come on again and talk about that?
Sure, if you'll have me.
I will have you. And check out this book, because we didn't get into everything. We're trying to keep it, because there's this new thing I'm doing, and I'm trying to keep it at an hour, or I'll do two shows, you know, it'll be a two-parter. But this book is fabulous, Fireball, Carol Lombard and the Mystery of Flight 3, written by Robert Mattson, and he also has, tell us the name of your Audrey book.
That is Dutch Girl, Audrey Hepburn, and World War II.
Yes, and I can't wait to read that. And do you have a website or anything we can go to, or just...
It's really tough to remember. It's robertmattson.com.
Robertmattson.com. I gotcha.
Yeah, so, M-A-T-Z-E-N.
Mm-hmm, I got your name. Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed this. This is not, you know, peppy cheery, but it was fascinating. And Happy New Year to you all. And thank you so much, Robert, for coming on. You were fabulous. And though you didn't remember everything, you remembered a lot. You remembered Bravo. Because how long ago did you write this book?
Well, 7 years ago.
Yeah. So, you know, you don't really, and then you work on a totally new book, and then you have to kind of refresh yourself a little bit. And you did fabulously. So I want to thank you so much. And thank you for being first guest of 2020.
It's an honor. Thank you very much.
Thanks. And Happy New Year, everybody. And keep listening. Great guests coming up, just like Robert. Take care. Bye.
His pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment. The lights on the lady in tights, or the bride with the guy on the side, or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment. A fight like you see on the screen, a swain getting slain for the love of a queen, some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet and everyone ends in mincemeat. The gag may be waving the flag that began with the Mr. Cohan, hip hooray.